From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, The Gospel According to Gore Vidal. His new novel is a satire of what it would have been like if TV had been around to cover the crucifixion. He also has a new book about movies, and he co-stars in a new film, the political satire Bob Roberts. Also, we meet bassist Charlie Hayden. He played free jazz with Ornette Coleman and co-founded the Liberation Music Orchestra. His new album, Haunted Heart, was inspired by film noir and detective fiction. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Jennifer Warnes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Labor Department says the nation's unemployment rate dropped slightly in August, the second decline in as many months. But economists say a summer jobs program accounts for much of the decline. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
The unemployment rate dropped to 7.6% last month, a decline of 0.1%. But most of that decline can be attributed to the government's summer jobs program for disadvantaged teenagers, a program that is now winding down. And economists say that the slight drop in the unemployment rate is overshadowed by the fact that the number of jobs outside of the farm sector actually dropped by 83,000. That's the largest decline in 9 months. The nation's central bank, the Federal Reserve, responded to that news by pumping more money into the nation's banking system, in effect lowering interest rates that banks charge one another for overnight loans. The hope is that money will be easier to borrow, and therefore businesses will be able to hire more workers. This is Eric Weiner in Washington.
Yugoslav Premier Milan Panic survived a no-confidence vote today in the parliament of the remaining Yugoslav Federation. Panic had come under harsh criticism from nationalist deputies who opposed his moves to help end the warfare in Bosnia. Panic, a naturalized American, won support from 66 of the 103 deputies present today after a lengthy debate. Opponents accused him of disloyalty to Serbia for pledging to recognize the borders of the former Yugoslav republics that have gained independence. Serbian nationalists also opposed Panic's efforts to negotiate with ethnic Albanians, who are the majority in Serbia's Kosovo province. Today, President Bush defended his recent actions in granting government favors to selected constituencies around the country. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Democrats say that in his bid for re-election, the president has been trying to play Santa Claus to voters. This week, he announced the federal government would rebuild Homestead Air Force Base and cover 100% of the cleanup cost after Hurricane Andrew. Later, he announced new subsidies for wheat exports and allowed the sale of F-16 fighter jets to Taiwan. Good news for the workers at the General Dynamics plant in Fort Worth, Texas. Campaigning today in Virginia, he rejected criticism from Democrats who say that he's trying to buy votes.
The Democrats ask him which of these proposals they stand against. Which ones are they against? They don't want to sell the airplanes in Texas. They don't want to help the farmer. Which ones? I mean, see, these are good, sound proposals. They fit into our budget structure. They create jobs.
That comment came just before the president announced a sevenfold increase in small business loan guarantees. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 10 points to close at 3,282. Declines edged advances by a slight margin in light trading. This is NPR News. Three people have surrendered after hijacking an Ethiopian jetliner to Djibouti on the Horn of Africa. The hijackers, two men and a woman, were armed with grenades. They released the flight's 46 passengers and gave themselves up after holding the four-member crew for several hours. Officials say they surrendered after receiving assurances that they will be allowed to seek asylum. The incident comes just a week after five Ethiopians commandeered an Ethiopian Airlines flight to Rome, claiming to be victims of political persecution. A European Community delegation visited famine-stricken Somalia to assess the situation and make recommendations to European leaders. The BBC's Colin Blaine traveled with the head of the EC delegation, British Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd.
It was a visit which involved a degree of risk for Douglas Hurd and his ministerial colleagues. They were escorted through the shattered city by speeding technicals, four-wheel drive vehicles mounted with machine guns, and occasional shots were heard. the delegation visited a feeding center, a hospital, and a camp for the displaced. Afterwards, Mr. Hurd asked why some United Nations agencies, notably the World Health Organization, weren't working in Somalia. He also said those people who'd responded to appeals should know that the aid agencies in Somalia were getting food through. Douglas Hurd's visit to Mogadishu comes at a time when Britain is president of the European Commission and Somalia has at last found its way onto the international agenda.
The BBC's Colin Blaine. There was more fighting reported today in the former Soviet Republic of Tajikistan. Government radio said that more than 30 people were killed in skirmishes between supporters and opponents of President Rahman Nabiyev in the southern border with Afghanistan. Yesterday, rebel forces claimed to have ousted Nabiyev, a former Communist Party leader. Today, the parliament and cabinet passed a vote of no confidence in the president. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Gore Vidal once said, "I do nothing but think about my country." But as you're about to hear, he doesn't think very highly of some of the latest developments in his country, like the state of politics, for instance. He's written extensively about politics in his essays and in his historical novels, such as Burr, 1876, and Lincoln. Gore Vidal's new satirical novel, Live from Golgotha, goes all the way back to the crucifixion and imagines what it would have been like had it been broadcast live on television. He also has a new book of essays called Screening History, about how his life has paralleled the history of movies. Vidal has written several screenplays, including The Best Man and Ben-Hur. Actually, now you can see him in a film that shares his cynical view of political campaigns. The movie is Bob Roberts, a satire starring, written, and directed by Tim Robbins. Robbins plays a folk-singing right-wing senatorial candidate from Pennsylvania. Vidal plays his opponent, the liberal incumbent. Vidal has appeared on screen before, but only in films he wrote or that were adapted from his books.
With Tim Robbins, it was the first time that I've actually been in somebody else's movie, except for 20 years ago when I appeared in Fellini's movie Roma, in which I played myself, which is no easy task, let me tell you.
Listen, did you put on a toga for your screenplay of Ben-Hur?
No, I didn't, but it might have helped matters if I had. No, I was just hanging around as the writer in residence at Cinecittà. That was Chuck Heston, who had been built by the time we got there. They'd built all the sets, and they built Heston out of solid balsa wood. And we had to then fill in dialogue to go with the sets. That was a very exciting experience. But this is the first time that a director, I didn't even know Tim was a director. I knew him as an actor, and he's great friend of an old friend of mine, Susan Sarandon. In fact, he is the father of her two children. They, by the way, last week they were baptized in the Roman Catholic Church.
The children or the parents?
Well, as they neglected to get married, I thought it was, you know, extremely irreverent gesture. Susan's Catholic, and Bob Altman, the director, and I were the godparents. And so I asked the priest, you know, are there any responses for us to make? And he said, no, simply present them with a serious way of life. And he gave me a gimlet eye during this. Altman looked away.
I guess you guys aren't the best role models, huh?
Well, I don't know. It depends on what you want to play. Anyway, Tim, out of the blue, just sent me a script called Bob Roberts. And would I like to play the part of the ineffectual liberal senator that he overwhelms in an election. As I thought this was no great weight upon my fragile thespian talent, I said, fine.
Now, your part was improvised, from what I understand. I guess.
No, it was some of it. It's mostly written, except the very end, after the senator is defeated. And that was an extra scene that Tim decided to shoot. In one day, I did 8 scenes, all of them written by him. And then he said, stay over the next morning. He said, I don't have permission to shoot another scene, but I want to do one. After you're defeated and you're brooding over the campaign, who is Bob Roberts, what happened to the United States in the last 30 years? And I said, okay, I'll do it, but don't tell me your questions. So he squatted down beside the camera and threw some questions at me, and I improvised, not as myself. I'm not Senator Paste at all. Senator Paste is very melancholy and burnt out, and I am still quite belligerent. But that's how those scenes came to be.
So what's the difference between what you think and what you had him think?
Well, I was in character, and he was a noble old thing, rather ineffectual. A friend of Kennedy came there with a new frontier. Everything had fallen apart in his lifetime, Vietnam, and he's burnt out. I'm not only not burnt out, I'm ready for war in politics. I see the country dividing now between what I call the Party of God, which we saw at Houston, and which Pat Buchanan and in a small way Bush speak for, and what I call the Party of Man, which in the election Jerry Brown in the primaries was speaking for. That's the Jeffersonian Party. That is the life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, the Bill of Rights. A nation of laws, not of men, and certainly not of religion. So if I were defeated for the Senate in that mood, I would say, okay, I'm leaving the Senate. I'm going to start a crusade against the Party of God, and I'm going to kick their teeth in. That would be my message to the troops.
Well, what bothers you most about how religion is being used in this presidential campaign?
Well, the founders of the country did not believe in our little Lord Jesus. This comes as an enormous surprise to Americans. But then they're not taught any history, so how would they know? The founding fathers were at best deists, which meant anything or nothing. They carefully saw to it that religion was kept out of the Constitution, out of our laws. The famous "In God We Trust" on the money came in the end of the 19th century, and the Pledge of Allegiance, the "Under God," came in under Eisenhower. God's not supposed to be mentioned in our affairs. We are not a godly republic. We are a republic of men, a republic, above all, of law and of a certain Bill of Rights. So I'm an old-fashioned reactionary. I want to get back to this. Now, I would say I wouldn't hurt people's feelings on the subject of religion, but they hurt my feelings. They've infiltrated every law of the land, whether it's protecting the sacred fetus, the sacred flag, or going after minorities. For sexual reasons, racial reasons, bigotry. It is the party of hate. Listen to Pat Buchanan, you hear the voice of the Party of God loud and clear, and it is a voice asking for confrontation, and I'm ready for it.
Gore Vidal, you have two books out, and one of them is a satire of both religion and the media, and it's called Live from Golgotha. Have you ever been a religious person? Did you have any religious upbringing, any religious aspect in your upbringing?
Well, I went to a church school in Washington, Episcopal school called St. Albans, for 4 or 5 years. But I'm a third or fourth generation atheist on both sides of the family. Senator Gore, my grandfather, senator from a Bible state, Oklahoma, was a complete atheist. He never let on to his constituents as they would be distressed. So I have had absolutely no... I know a good deal about religion, after all. I wrote Julian some 20 years ago, an examination of the apostate emperor of the 4th century who tried to stop Christianity, and in it you get a rather serious analysis of how the Trinity was invented at a series of synods in the 4th century A.D. Now in Live from Golgotha, I've done a sort of satire. I think it's a funny book about St. Paul and Timothy, really. And Timothy is kind of Robin to St. Paul's Batman, and they go around inventing this religion to the horror of the Jews, who regard Christianity quite correctly as a Jewish heresy. And so I show a lot of the struggles between the Jews in Jerusalem and what St. Paul is busy inventing. And then Live from Golgotha means NBC... through General Electric, which owns them. NBC is suffering in the ratings, and suddenly General Electric has come up with a method whereby they can get a live crew back to Golgotha for the crucifixion of Jesus, an all-union crew, by the way, and with Timothy acting as anchor person. Meanwhile, Shirley MacLaine has already channeled in, so this gives you the background of what I took to be a rather... if not reverent, rather funny story.
Can I ask if you were ever baptized?
Yeah, I was, and I was confirmed in the Episcopal Church.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have a great deal of control over that. I was in school, and we all went through the through the forms.
Right. Okay, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Gore Vidal. He has two new books. One is a satire called Live from Golgotha, and the other is an extended essay on movies. It's called Screening History. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Gore Vidal is my guest. I don't think that one is allowed to write an article about you, Gore Vidal, without using the word patrician.
Yeah, well, I thought the word was outrageous. That's the one my eye picks up on.
Okay, and patrician, I even looked it up in the dictionary so I'd really get this precise. Patrician, first meaning is a person of refined upbringing, manners, and taste. Second definition, person of aristocratic family. How do you like it when that word is applied to you?
I sort of don't see it. We're supposed to be a classless society. Of course, we're not. I would be literally patrician in the sense that the senators in ancient Rome were called conscript fathers, paters, from which comes the word patrician. So if you come from a senatorial family, you are literally patrician in that sense, but that doesn't mean that you couldn't be Billy Carter, you know, of recent memory.
Do you think it's unusual for someone who's called patrician all the time to be as kind of vitriolic as you sometimes are, as outspoken? And
well, when you say vitriolic, now that is a loaded word.
Is that I didn't look up that one, and I tend to use words sloppily. Maybe I picked the wrong one. How would you define vitriolic? Let's see, maybe
well,
I used it
vitriolic
badly.
Is a needless and malign attack on something, excessive attack on something that is a rather pointless thing to do. If I were to say that Barbara Bush was born with two heads and one was removed, you know, at birth and is waiting to be restored, that would be a vitriolic, if slightly off the wall, account. I'm never personal. Vitriolic really is personal.
Okay.
I am vitriolic. I am savage.
Savage. Let's go with savage.
Well, that's okay. Better.
Savage, acid?
I am savage about what has been done to the United States by its mm-hmm. rulers.
Okay, so is it a contradiction for someone who is a patrician to be savage at the same time?
Patricians can be savage. I think what you're trying to say is, why should a member of the ruling class question the ruling class?
There you go.
That's it. Well, because... no reform ever came from the bottom. And it was always people who understood how the ruling class worked who turned out to be the reformers.
This is great. So you think, like, the noblesse oblige, as it applies to you, is to kind of help stir up revolution?
Well, I didn't say that. You said that. But if revolution, if a dissolution is,
okay,
is what's
right.
coming, and I would like to see it in an orderly way, and I'd like to restore... I'm a true reactionary, like all patricians. I'd like to restore the original republic, which we lost 40 years ago when Harry Truman imposed the national security state on us, which has kept us at war, hot or cold, for almost half a century, and has got us $4 trillion into debt. Well, now, to point that out is to be outrageous, vicious, vitriolic, because I'm taking on the entire ruling class of the country, which has decided in the corporate boardrooms that this is the way we were going to live all those years.
I must, for better or worse, pursue this patrician line of questioning one step further. One of your more, I think, famous television appearances was in 1968 when you and William Buckley, also a patrician.
Not by my measurement.
Okay. Well, you were both on as commentators during the 1968 Democratic Convention from Chicago, and you were commentators for ABC. And you called Buckley a crypto-fascist, and do you remember what he said to you?
No, but I remember laughing at him.
Okay.
And he was climbing the wall.
Well,
I always thought the object of a debate was to reduce the other person to hysteria, which turned out to be the case.
Well, I was reading a quote in the newspaper today about what Buckley said after you called him a crypto-fascist. He said, now listen, you queer, stop calling me a crypto-fascist or I'll sock you in the G-damned face and you'll stay plastered.
Well, he's such a weak little thing. And he, you know, I am, for those of you who cannot see me on this radio program, I'm over 6 foot tall and weigh 200 pounds and was working out regularly in those days.
Did you enjoy these kinds of go-rounds on TV when they happen?
I don't think much about it.
But did the network have anything to say about it? Did they reprimand you and Buckley afterwards?
Well, they went number one in the ratings. I don't think they were too disturbed. ABC had never been number one in prime time before. We were the making of that network, at least at that hour of the evening.
Did you and Buckley have words off the air after your go-round on
No,
the air?
I never spoke to him again.
Ever?
Never, no. I don't like him. Uh-huh. Why should I speak to him?
Okay. Now, I should mention here that you ran for office twice. You ran for Congress in 1960, and you ran for California senator in the Democratic primary opposite Jerry Brown in 1982. What kind of senator do you think you would have been had you actually gotten into the Senate?
It's not for me to describe, but for those who want to read me, they can figure out. There are 6 books of essays, many of them political. You'd have a very clear idea of what I would do had I been elected.
Well, did you think you would have been effective at doing it?
More than most, but not very, because the system is closed. There is nothing an individual senator can do. If he doesn't want to be reelected, he can ask certain questions. I mean, you could certainly start a movement to try and get the CIA to explain its budget to a Senate open hearing of a committee. Things like that could have been done. Questions could be asked.
Gore Vidal, your grandfather, Thomas Gore, was a senator from Oklahoma. He was blind, and you'd sometimes read to him. So you must have known your grandfather fairly well. What were your impressions when your grandfather was a senator about what it meant to be in politics in America?
Well, in this is the 30s, 20s and 30s. United States was a very serious country then, and the senators took themselves seriously. And until Roosevelt really got going, the Senate had been governing the United States for quite some time. And as they proved when Woodrow Wilson came up with the League of Nations, and they handed him his head. The Senate was very powerful. And I grew up in my grandfather's house. I lived with him till I was 10. And I used to go down to the Senate with him, and I knew many of the players, like Huey Long. It was a very serious place. Now they look like displaced anchor persons, you know, from around the country, not yet ready for network. It's a sad lot, and I'm very happy not to be one of them.
Your cousin, I think 6th or 7th cousin, is Al Gore, who is now running for vice president. Can I ask your thoughts about him?
Well, not many. I don't know him. I knew his father, Senator Albert Gore I, who was a very nice man. The only reason anybody knows that I kept it a secret all these years until recently that I am a 5th cousin of Jimmy Carter, and I kept that a secret all through his administration. Unfortunately, with the similarity of the names between Albert Gore and me, it has come out that we are related. I take no joy in the relationship, as he's a typical conservative, southern, Pentagon senator. The South loves the defense industries, and he has never voted against a defense industry, an appropriation for the Pentagon. I'm not very optimistic about him, but I suppose it's... you see, once you're in the system, he's been running for president all his life, really since about 10 years old, and I know the feeling. But he knows no life at all except being brought up in a senator's household in Washington and then going into the House of Representatives and going into the Senate and vice president. There's been no life. There's been no mind. Not that he isn't perfectly intelligent, but it's very bad for character to spend all your life running for office. And if you don't have a character before you assume office, you're never going to get one. Look at Richard Nixon, perfect example of somebody who just kept running. Well, you run and you run and you run, and suddenly you find you're just something running. There's no character. There's no mind. There is no plan. And I'm rather wary. I gave that advice to Jerry Brown in the one confrontation we had in 82. And they asked me what advice would I give him and what advice he would give me. And I said, you know, you're going to lose in the general whether I beat you in the primary or not. Republicans are going to take it. I said, you've been running for office all your life. Stop it. Take 10 years off. Think. Because he's far more intelligent than most people in politics.
So
he did exactly that.
You think that your talk was one of the reasons why he left politics for a while?
No, I don't. But I think it certainly made an impression on him if you look at the tape.
You've said that your upbringing was in a way very similar to George Bush's, although you certainly see the world very differently. What were the similarities in your upbringing to his?
Well, he's the son of a senator. I'm the grandson of a senator. And my father was in the cabinet. We're both Washington children, government children, both politically ambitious. When I was at Exeter, he was at Andover. He's a year older than I am. When I was 17, I enlisted in the Army. When he was 18, he enlisted in the Navy. And we were both in the Second World War, so we've had parallel lives. And frankly, I prefer mine to his. I would not like to be George Bush. And I think history, he's not going to even make it up there with Herbert Hoover.
What does it say to you that two people who shared so much in the way they were brought up would turn out so absolutely differently?
Well, no one knows about personality. I'd say, obviously, genetic differences in our families. The Gores, I think, are a bit brighter than the Bushes, historically speaking. But I think more than that, I have a question. Well, I was born a writer. He was born somebody who wants to be appointed to political office and then eventually elected to political office. I was intrigued and drawn to that. It was the family business. But after all, I wrote my first novel when I was 19 in the Pacific and have supported myself as a writer since I was 20. Also, you can't be both a writer and a politician. At least not a good writer. A writer must always tell the truth as he sees it, and the politician must never give the game away. Now, these are two opposing forces. And whenever I am in active politics, I stop writing. And when I'm writing, I don't politic.
Are you going to vote in the election?
Well, I haven't voted since 64. When I voted for Lyndon Johnson, the peace candidate. That's presidential. I vote for, I vote in local elections, but not for president.
Really?
Well, there's no difference. There is nothing to vote for. There is only one party. Well, I don't like the one party, so why should I vote?
Would you have voted for Ross Perot if you were running?
Maybe just to overthrow the system, yes. And I think he's going to run, by the way.
You think he's going to re-enter?
Oh, sure. He just got on the ballot in California last week. I was out there when it was happening. That costs money. You don't do that just for idle sport. He's on in New York. He will be on all 50. And once the other two have covered themselves in mud, he can come in the last two or three weeks with a lot of ads. And who knows what'll happen.
Okay. Well, Gore Vidal, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Gore Vidal has two new books. One is called Live from Golgotha, The Gospel According to Gore Vidal, and the other is called Screening History, and it's a personal essay about movies. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bassist Charlie Hayden played free jazz with Ornette Coleman in the 60s. Later, he formed the Liberation Music Orchestra. This forward-looking musician looks back on his new record to the era of classic film noir. Coming up, Charlie Hayden tells us why. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Jennifer Warnes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Hurricane Andrew will cost an estimated $20 billion in damages and about $10 billion in cleanup expenses. But in other ways, Andrew is resulting in more personal costs. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports from Miami.
The Centers for Disease Control is warning that stress and cleanup hazards in the areas ripped apart by the hurricane have caused some sudden deaths. Officials say 8 people died after the storm from stress-induced heart attacks, and 2 children died in a house fire. Cases of domestic violence have also increased. Florida police say the extensive damage is making things worse. A Dade County judge has asked the military to give priority to rebuilding shelters for the victims of domestic violence. In Louisiana, federal officials say they'll truck in mobile homes, open apartments, and houses to provide shelter for people there whose homes have been destroyed. Housing officials plan to make about 1,400 such homes available, but they say there's no need to set up the military's tent cities in Louisiana, as they've done in Florida. I'm Kathy Lohr in Miami.
The White House calls the small drop in the nation's unemployment rate an encouraging sign, but the Labor Secretary says the slight decline may not last past the summer. NPR's Paz Cohen reports.
Labor Secretary Lynn Martin said she's glad to see any decline in the official unemployment figures, but Martin acknowledged the 0.1% drop resulted from the temporary hiring of 100,000 young people last month through a congressionally sponsored summer jobs program.
What we're saying here is let's not just say, isn't it all wonderful, although we think that there's a good that it's a drop. I mean, it's hardly... That's not bad news. But yes, it's part of the summer jobs program, and could that affect next month? It might.
A total of 175,000 teenagers found jobs under the summer program. A separate survey of employers' payrolls found non-farm jobs fell by 83,000 in August, the worst decline in 9 months. I'm Paz Cohen in Washington.
President Bush today described himself as the champion of small businesses and accused his opponent Bill Clinton of wanting to overtax Americans. Mr. Bush campaigned in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and signed a law increasing federal loans to small business owners. He criticized Clinton's support for national health care, claiming it would force small firms to fire workers or cut salaries to pay for it. The Clinton campaign responded that under Mr. Bush, bankruptcies have grown faster than jobs. In Munich, Germany, a ceremony was held today to observe the 20th anniversary of the 1972 massacre of 11 Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics. Family members, German officials, and Israeli embassy staff spoke out against the recent right-wing violence in Germany. For 2 weeks, rightist groups have protested against foreign refugees. Stock prices close lower on Wall Street today, with the Dow Jones Industrials losing 10 points. This is NPR. Allied pilots in southern Iraq report no evidence of Iraqi military action against Shiites in the area. Iraqi media have said troops set fires to drive out the Shiites and crushed a rebellion in one village. One American commander says pilots would probably see the fires, and a British officer says he hasn't seen anything abnormal. The U.S., France, and Britain have set up a no-fly zone in southern Iraq to protect Shiites there. 2 Russian warships will join the effort soon. The former Soviet Central Asian Republic of Tajikistan remains essentially without a government today, amid reports of renewed violence that may have left at least 30 people dead. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
The whereabouts of Tajikistan's President Rahmon Nabiyev are still unknown. He disappeared at the beginning of the week after opposition demonstrators stormed the presidential residence in Dushanbe, the Tajik capital, and took several dozen government officials hostage. Today, the Tajik parliament was supposed to meet to decide whether to declare the president removed from power. But most state away, thus effectively paralyzing any attempt to resolve the power vacuum in Tajikistan. Meanwhile, local radio in Dushanbe is reporting more clashes in the south of the country. For several months, this region, known as Kurgan-Tube, has been the scene of sporadic violence between government supporters and opponents. At the same time, the governments of Russia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan announced today that they may send additional border troops to Tajikistan to stop the flow of arms that are being smuggled into the country from neighboring Afghanistan. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Yugoslav Prime Minister Milan Panic survived a no-confidence vote today. Serbian nationalist deputies brought the vote. They opposed his promise to recognize the borders of the former Yugoslav republics that have gained independence. A team of United Nations officials will travel to several African nations this month, including Somalia. They'll meet with Somali warlord Mohamed Farah Adid, who has blocked UN troops from guarding relief supplies in some parts of the country. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest Charlie Hayden was a member of the original Ornette Coleman Quartet, which created a revolution in jazz. Hayden also leads the Liberation Music Orchestra, which has taken inspiration from songs of revolution in Latin America and Spain. But his new album isn't about revolution. It evokes the atmosphere of classic film noir and the Los Angeles of the 40s as described by Raymond Chandler. Hayden moved to Los Angeles in 1956 from Missouri. His new album, Haunted Heart, includes standards and original compositions. It features Alan Broadbent on piano, Ernie Watts on tenor saxophone, Lawrence Marable drums, and of course, Charlie Hayden on bass. This is a Broadbent composition, Lady in the Lake.
I've always felt that I was born in the wrong era, really. I wanted to be friends with John Garfield, for instance. He was one of the only actors that refused to testify in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee back in when the Hollywood 10 was happening, McCarthy period. And I wish I could have been friends with Charlie Parker and played with him. You know, that's my period. I feel real close to the 40s. And actually, I was born in 37, so I was a kid singing on the radio in the 40s, but I always dreamed of going to big cities, you know, from the Midwest, and I used to stand in front of the mirror with my brother's raincoat on and my dad's hat and dream that I was in New York on Broadway, you know, walking down the street at night.
That's great. That's great. So, you know, I love what you've done here on the record, because several times what you've done is, you know, you've taken a singer from the 40s or 50s and juxtapose that with your interpretation of the same song. The title track of your new record, Haunted Heart, that's a Dietz and Schwartz song. And on this record, your group plays it, and then you follow it up with a 1947 Joe Stafford recording of Haunted Heart. Let's play your version. Can you just say a few words about the mood that you wanted to get across on this?
I wanted people to get a visual experience, you know, of being in the city in 1946 at night in a nightclub and seeing someone like Joe Stafford singing this song. It's a very special, you know, I mean, all of this bringing this music back to people is a feeling of mine that back in the 40s and 30s, popular music had very, very deep values. It's a lot different today. And back then, records that were selling millions and millions of copies were bands like Duke Ellington and Fletcher Henderson and the Pied Pipers and Tommy Dorsey and Glenn Miller and Frank Sinatra. And I wanted people to remember those deep values that most people had back then in music and also remember moments in their lives, you know, that bringing back a precious moment in their life that gives them a really great feeling and they remember why they're alive and why we're all here and how important life is and should be to each one of us.
Well, let's hear the Charlie Hayden Quartet version of Haunted Heart from their new album of the same name. On the record, your version of Haunted Heart segues into Joe Stafford's recording of it. What was your thinking behind that?
I wanted to give people, the listener, a feeling of us playing the song now and being inspired by the recording of Joe Stafford, and also our feelings of, my feeling of Bill Evans playing the song. But to give them a feeling of hearing the music now and hearing the music from the version of it that inspired us to play it, which was back in 1948.
I was kind of surprised to find your deep appreciation of jazz and pop singers from the 40s and 50s. I knew that you were interested in a kind of political song from Spain and from Central and Latin America, but I didn't know this connection before. And, you know, the music, for instance, that you played with Ornette Coleman was really a kind of music that wasn't about singers. Do you know what I mean? Although singers later tried to find words that would fit into the original compositions that the quartet did.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, I was just kind of surprised at that connection.
Well, I've been connected to singing all my life. My family were singers, and I was a singer from the time I was 2 years old until I was 15 on the radio. And my parents were on the Grand Ole Opry before I was born. And so I knew great singer, country singers like the Carter family and the Delmore brothers. And my father was friends with Jimmy Rogers and Woody Guthrie and Roy Acuff and all those people. So I knew those singers and Hank Williams. And when I started listening to the radio when I was a kid, you know, and listening to the different singers in pop music, I really loved it. And the first time I heard Jerry Southern, for instance, I just fell in love with her voice because she was the first singer I'd ever heard besides Billie Holiday that really sang the way she spoke. You know, there was no difference in the inflections, the enunciation, the pronunciation, the breath, the phrasing was the way she would be talking to you, you know, and she was expressing herself in song like that, and it's very rare.
My guest is bass player Charlie Hayden. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charlie Hayden. He has a new album called Haunted Heart. What kind of material were you singing when you were young and singing with your family on the radio?
We were singing what they called back then hillbilly music and mountain music and folk music. And that's what we sang every day of my life. And from the time I was 2 until I was 15, we had radio shows in the morning and in the afternoon. And
why did you give up singing when you were 15?
Well, my father kind of wanted to get out of the business and build a fishing lodge and do that kind of thing afterwards. And I actually had polio when I was 15, bulbar polio, and it paralyzed the nerves to my vocal cords and the left side of my throat and face. And I got over it, but I never really got my voice back strong, you know. So that's really why I stopped. And then I really became interested in instrumental music and playing jazz.
Did you start playing bass after you could no longer sing?
I started playing bass. My brother, older brother, played bass on our radio show, and when he used to go off somewhere, I would sneak in and grab his bass and play with the jazz records that we had. And that's the way I learned how to play. I kind of taught myself how to play. And after I got into my teens, there were no musicians to play with around the area that played jazz, and so I played with records until I went to L.A.
If your voice hadn't been affected by the polio, do you think you'd want to sing today?
I think so. I really play my instrument as if I were singing with you know, breathing and everything. I really feel close to melodies, and I feel close to making things sound singing, you know. I think I would.
In the liner notes for the new Quartet West album, you quote a passage from the Raymond Chandler 1949 novel, The Little Sister. This is a passage about how Los Angeles was changed by Hollywood. Reading that passage about how Los Angeles was changing made me wonder what Los Angeles was like for you when you left the Midwest as a young man to go to Los Angeles.
I had been raised, you know, in the Midwest and small town, rural kind of thing, and getting into L.A. was kind of an overwhelming experience for me. It was very, very exciting and very wonderful, and I started playing right away with very, very good musicians, which was lucky for me because I found out as I went along that the way you really learn the art form of jazz is to learn it from musicians who are really great and are dedicated to the art form. And I merged into the nightlife very quickly and started playing so much that I had to drop out of school because I was cutting classes in the mornings. I was getting home very late and sleeping late. My career just took off from there as far as, you know, playing with people like Hampton Hawes and Sonny Clark and Dexter Gordon and Art Pepper and then Paul Blay and then Ornette.
Did you leave home or did your family come with you to Los Angeles?
Oh, no, I left home. I loved, you know, Missouri, but it was a very racist part of the country, and I couldn't leave fast enough, to tell you the truth. I knew that there was nothing I could do to make it better while I was there. If I wanted to make it better and improve the country, I had to do it through the music. And in order to do that, I had to go somewhere where the music was happening. And I left.
You know what I find really interesting? Your first records with Ornette Coleman were were regarded as very far out, very avant-garde, like nothing that had come before, very controversial, not only in jazz, but even people who didn't listen to much jazz found it controversial. And listening to this record and hearing you talk about it, you know, I get a sense of someone who's really very much steeped in the past as well. And, you know, you said that you sometimes wish that you had, you know, been part of the 40s, you know, that you thought you were in the mm-hmm. wrong era. And I find mm-hmm. it kind of paradoxical that on the one hand, you know, your music has been so forward-looking, and on the other hand, you feel so rooted and even nostalgic for the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's very important to live in the present. One of the great things that improvising teaches you is the magic of the moment that you're in and the importance of living in the moment, because when you improvise, you're in right now. You're not in yesterday or tomorrow. You're right in the moment. And it, being in that moment really gives you a perspective of life that you never get at any other time as far as learning about your ego. First, you see your unimportance. And you have to see your unimportance before you can see your importance and your significance to the world. And you really, the artist is very lucky, because in an art form that's spontaneous like that, that's when you really see your true self, you know. And that's why, you know, when I put down my instrument, the challenge, that's when the challenge starts, because to live, to learn how to be that kind of human being at that level that you are when you're playing or when you're approaching playing, that's the key, you know, that's the hard part. And when I put my instrument down, I'm in trouble, you know. I try to live up to that level of being a musician and being close to music. But as far as being nostalgic, I think it's important to remember beautiful things in the past.
Charlie Hayden, I thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much, Terry.
Charlie Hayden's new album, Haunted Heart, features his group Quartet West. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we have a piece from Florida, which I think is going to be fascinating. The building inspectors are going around now and red-tagging those houses which have to be torn down. And as you might imagine, the people who are living in even those fragments of houses are not at all glad to see the building inspector coming. We also have an interview with Carl Hyacin of the Miami Herald about development in Florida and the dangers to the environment that it has obviously posed. And then some political stories, the New York Senate race, where there are two women candidates figuring very importantly in that race, and a piece on debates, presidential candidate debates.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's been 5 years since singer Jennifer Warren's last release, which was the widely acclaimed collection of Leonard Cohen songs, Famous Blue Raincoat. Now she's back with a new album of songs she's written herself or in collaboration with others. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
All your life loves hurt you, turned you out, then burned you, held you high. Then it dropped you down. I know your heart's been broken. Trust don't come so easily. It takes time, that's alright. Just let me heal your heart tonight. I will rock you gently.
That's the first song on The Hunter, and it's Jennifer Warren's bid for a hit single, a pretty, catchy song that jogs your memory of her voice. Warren's biggest commercial successes in recent years have been with movie soundtracks. For An Officer and a Gentleman, she sang Up Where We Belong with Joe Cocker. For Dirty Dancing, she did I've Had the Time of My Life with Bill Medley. But The Hunter reestablishes Warren's as a solitary singer, one who possesses as lovely a voice as anyone in pop music.
Come on over, sporting friend, bring your favorite weapon. me how you make your mark from the whistle in the wind to the center of the heart. The moon is full, the night is clear, hunting season is drawing near. Show me how you claim your ground, pull the arrow back, take one down, and maybe tonight, maybe you'll show what you feel behind your bow, and maybe I'll go hunting too, down in the valley with you.
Warrens has never achieved the sort of stardom that came to West Coast colleagues like Linda Ronstadt and Joni Mitchell. I think that's due in part to the fact that Warrens never wrote material as consistently distinctive as Mitchell's. And despite the fact that some of us find horn-rimmed glasses awfully sexy, she never resorted to the flirty persona that Ronstadt sometimes used to get her artistry across. At her best, however, Warrens has always had a unique quality, a kind of grave sensuality, that gives her music enormous resonance and emotion. In this respect, the finest song on The Hunter is also the most idiosyncratic, a brooding chant called Way Down Deep.
Way down, way, way down, way, way down deep. You've got me way down, way, way down, way, way down deep. You've got me way down deep. I wander with you in my sleep. I'm way down, way, way down, way, way down deep. It came to me this morning, I was walking down the street. Like my soul could taste you, and God, you tasted sweet. And finally I can breathe again, finally I can speak. I've got you in the glory place, I've got you way down deep. I've got you way down, way, way down, way, way down deep. You've got me way down, way, way down, way, way down deep. You've got me way down deep. I wander with you in my sleep, I'm way down.
Despite the pop melodiousness of her singing, Jennifer Warrens is an eccentric artist, using unusual metaphors and instrumentation to get at, as she puts it in the title of one song here, true emotion. Most of the time, she achieves it.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurock directs Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, what work is. Philip Levine put in years at the factory before he left for his true calling, poetry. The factory was close to hell, but he's still writing poems about it. And we talk with actor John Cullum, who plays Holling Vincour on Northern Exposure. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air. On the next Fresh Air, what work is. Philip Levine put in years at the factory before he left for his true calling, poetry. The factory was closed.